Well, in our special edition of Outliers today, we speak with Jay Naidu, a man who's well known amongst South African of pretty much every age, but very much so of my vintage. We'll be finding out more from Jay, what he's up to at the moment and how he got to where he went to. Jay, thanks for joining us. We've been in the biz news with very hard-hitting commentary. Really, I wanted to know more about you and your story and your background. I know we're both from the same province. We're both from KwaZulu-Natal, but we certainly came from very, very different angles to where we are today. Interesting to see that you were in a big family, a very big family.
Yes, my father had 8 children, 7 with my mother, and I was the youngest. So my father was nearly 60 years old when I was born. He was born actually in 1898. That's like 2 centuries ago, you know. And they, you know, it was a particular generation that was born. You know, they didn't have the type of relationship with children that we have today. You know, it was very much, you know, the children are part of the mother's work of raising. And if even if he wanted to talk to us, it was through my mother. Tell the children to do this. So I come from that type of background, and I, of course, grew up at the height of apartheid. So he was an interpreter at court. And interestingly enough, there always used to be people coming to the house, you know, and meeting with him. And I never understood that because he would never have a meeting with me or show any emotional attachment to me. But I learned later that they were coming there with their cases, because he was the interpreter. And if he really believed that someone was innocent, it didn't matter what they said in the court. He would present the story and actually make the decision that the magistrate would have made based on the facts that my father gave to him. So in a sense, that was part of his struggle and his exercise of his power. But he did teach me. Even with great resistance, I tried to not cooperate, but it was difficult not to cooperate. Listen to BBC when I was 10 and 12 years old and read Time magazine and Reader's Digest. So he taught me about the world, even though he never went on an aeroplane.
Well, what did he interpret? Was it Zulu to English?
I think many languages, in fact, but a number of the Indian languages as well. But he spoke Zulu fluently. And that's something that we lost because of the apartheid separation, the Group Areas Act, and then going to Indian schools or colored schools or white schools or Zulu schools. My father and mother came out of the community being able to communicate with many languages, and we lost that.
It's interesting reading your story that apartheid impacted you in a practical level at a very young age, where your family was relocated. We all know of District 6 in Cape Town, but it wasn't just in Cape Town that this happened.
No, I think it happened to throughout the country. The statistics are that 3 million people were moved out of their homes. And so we were the statistic. You know, I was 4 years old when we were evicted because we were on the wrong side of the wrong street at the wrong time. And so social engineering took us to a new place. And it's something I never understood. And it actually made me quite angry because I loved the community I was born in. It was a beautiful little valley with a little river through it, with lots of mango trees, fruit trees, very established community. And then suddenly we wrenched out and no one tells you why, because no one wants to talk about it. You're just a 4-year-old, but you're wounded by that. And then you go to another place, and it's only years later you learn that actually it was because we were the wrong color, you know. So these things, you may not be conscious of it at the moment, but they do carry the sort of syndrome of that wounded inner child that I had alongside millions of other people that we still carry as a wound today within us that we have to heal.
It's an extraordinary story, the South African story of impacting throughout generations. But for some people, like you, it sticks. And this belief in the underdog, this fighting for those who don't really have a voice for themselves, is pretty deeply embedded in you. What was it that gave you this fire?
There are many reasons. You know, one was my mother. She had a great influence on the values that I hold very dear in my heart today. She unfortunately passed in 1989, just a year before Mandela was released. But she was also at one point arrested, detained to be questioned about me in the late 70s. You know, I mean, she had that experience and that fear. My father died when I was 17 years old. So, and I have a very, you know, but though powerful, but it was a relationship with an older person rather than a father figure. And so my mother was really important, and she was a housewife, but she also drove a car in the 30s and 40s, you know, so she came out of a family that had resources, and she got married when she was 28, which was really unusual in the Indian community at that point. But she taught me values of integrity, of compassion, of service, and even in matters of faith and spirituality, you know, she always explained to me, because we never went to the temple, but she did a simple ceremony at home every day. And she explained things to me that we are all part of different tributaries that go through a great river that carries us to one ocean of humanity. So it doesn't matter what the person's color is, what their religion is, what their status is. When they come in, there must be always a bowl of food for them. So right from those days, I grew up with this notion that, in fact, service is the purpose of life. You know, if you can bring something greater to someone who is facing misfortune or adversity or is vulnerable, then I was taught by my mother, you'll always be very special and very careful and attentive to the needs of people who may not have the same, you know, advantages that you have. And that's followed me throughout life. And then suddenly when I was 15, also a very angry young person, like we see so many angry young people today in the world. And I was taken to a meeting by my elder brother that was addressed by Steve Biko. I was 15 years old. And I go into this Lutheran church. I can remember it as if it happened yesterday. It's like, you know, it was electrifying. It was surrounded by the police. There were crowds of people there, small church hall packed to the limit, and all of us expectant about this charismatic, you know, philosophical leader of the Black Consciousness Movement who comes out and, you know, it's like, you know, this the thought of him speaking, you know, I can remember it, you know. We have nothing to lose but our chains, because the mind of the oppressed is the main weapon in the hands of the oppressor. And then there's the security police sitting right there. He taught me about courage, about defense. Defend your idea, because that idea is what you would live far beyond what we live physically in our life. So from my parents, I learned protect your name. And that is through service and integrity. It's a family name. You are the tip of a long spear of thousands of generations before you that have given you this name, and you carry their memories in your body. So reflect on that before you do something silly. Because though we are born with free will, there's this duality of opposites. We can be generous, or we can be, you can be the grump, you know? You can be loving or fearful or hateful. These are the choices we have in life. Choose the one that takes you upwards towards a greater consciousness, a greater awakening. And that's why I joined politics. I got inspired by Steve Biko. And it wasn't that he had a business plan or a PowerPoint presentation, or he had money to give us free T-shirts even. You know, he had no money, Alec. He gave us an idea. He gave us a direction. Then it was up to me as an individual to decide, what do I do with this wisdom, this inspiration? He has captured my imagination. And that's what we should today. But ask yourself, Alec, how many people can inspire us today in politics, whether in our country or the world today?
Just fast forwarding in your own journey and your own career through the trade union movements, which we could spend a whole discussion on, to the heady times of 1994, when you're in your 30s, Trevor Manuel in his 30s, Tito Mboweni in their 30s. I remember having those conversations with you guys, and it was so exciting. The world was South Africa's oyster. It was there were good, powerful, wise people under Nelson Mandela, for heaven's sake, who were taking this country to a different level. It's worth sometimes going back there, not wondering too much about what happened, what went wrong, because I think that's well documented. But that time, surely that kind of period could be recaptured with the right young minds who embrace it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Alec. And I think that's our purpose, why we exist. You know, if my generation could just learn to listen with their hearts rather than their heads, just to say that we went into power all excited but passionate about doing the best we could. And in spite of the best we could, look at where the country is today. So can we co-create now a new conversation on everything? So we're not defending what we did in the past and feeling attacked or criticized or undermined or sold out or fingers pointed at. We have to co-create an authentic intergenerational dialogue and cooperation. But that first and foremost requires us as elders and the people of my generation to say, yes, the world that we are living in today is completely different to the world that we have come from. Take the experience of my own father. You know, to my grandchild who was 3 weeks old when he's going to go and see his great-grandparents in Canada from here. You know, so, you know, this, the world has changed. Technology has changed the world forever. And there are positives to that, but there are also deep negatives to that. Surely we need to pause for the moment because the times are urgent. And just recalibrate a little bit. You know, we are facing so many multiple dangers in the world, you know, a conventional war that is rising. Look at the wars, resource wars across our continent itself. What's happening in Swaziland, what's happening in northern Mozambique, what's still happening in the Sudan. Look at what's happening in Ukraine and Russia and NATO. And we can't go back to that, Alec. We can't go back to conventional war and the threat of nuclear war and the new arms race and how much resources gets channeled into that. And at the end of all that destruction, we have to still come back and talk. So how do we talk today, but rationally? How do we give people who may have their own point of view, their own truth, the opportunity to be present their truth so that at the end of the day, us as people are exposed to all points of view so that we come using our own intelligence to our own positions in life and decisions in life. Isn't that what democracy was about? That it's informed consent, it's a presentation of all the facts, it's for people to make up their own mind, for leaders to be accountable, there to be good governance, there to be ethics and leadership, that we can trust people that are in power. Now, why has that all been flung out of the window? And that's my question today that the next generation needs to answer, because it's their chance to find their voice, to find their agency, to find their own struggles, and to find their own destiny. And we should be as intergenerationally be prepared on all our platforms to look, listen to each other and not talk past each other. That's my only prayer, actually.
It's a wonderful prayer. And as you wrote in a recent piece for BizNews, it's a grandfather's prayer as well, to have better for for the next generation. I heard this morning a friend said to me, we spend such little time on Earth, we can't change it, but at least we might make a dent in a positive sense. But looking back, Jay, looking back at those heady times in the 1990s where we had such talent in politics in South Africa, why did you guys all leave? You went into business. So did the other two that I mentioned a moment ago, Trevor Manuel, Tito Mboweni. These were times when perhaps the foundations for the new democracy really need to be solidified. Does that torture you at all, thinking, if only I'd stayed a bit longer?
No. I've gone through so many different changes in my life. You know, I was a student activist in South African Students Organization. And when I decided in the late 70s to go into trade unions, I went into trade unions, and I did that until I decided that it was the right time for us to translate some of our noble ideas into the Reconstruction Development Program and go into government with it. You know, but when I leave government, I'm doing something else. I became the chair of the Development Bank of Southern Africa. I became the global chair of the an alliance, a foundation dealing with malnutrition facing 2 billion people in the world. I joined Moi Bryan Foundation to look at governance and ethics and ethical leadership in Africa. So I'm always busy. And it's many different roles that I've played. And I feel, in fact, inspired by the fact and knowledge that I've gained and understanding how much greater my ignorance is than my actual knowledge. So I have this insatiable curiosity. So we add all of these things. But you know, and I know, when we went into 1994, into the cabinet, maybe I was a bit naive. You know, I thought we were all on the same page, actually, you know, what we want to do to transform this country. And then suddenly you hit the, you know, you got the hands of the steering wheel, and everyone wants to drive. And then you are seen, especially as a minister that was looking at how do we build a cross-cutting program, not the silo-based mentalities of formerly traditional government. Then you start tramping on toes. And then you realize, Alec, that not everyone is on the same page. And then you start to understand, okay, we all had different historical routes to get to where we are. Ours was the mass struggle of this country, you know, in the trenches, building the union movement. But also the union movement, it's always been independent. And, you know, political parties don't really like independent movements, even though they have to work with us. And then suddenly you find that, you know, if your history and political pedigree was through black consciousness, independent trade unionism, then into politics, there are advantages to that, but there are also disadvantages, you know. And then you have people coming in from exile who sometimes believe that they were the government in exile. You know, but we didn't come into Pretoria with tanks and waving ANC flags. You know, we came in through a negotiated settlement. So you had people that were in prison who also believe that they held the status of actually the wisest and the people that initiated and pioneered things. So, you know, that's the mishmash of politics. Anywhere in any political party, you're going to have that. And so suddenly that basis of social cohesion, political cohesion, disappears. And then you start to feel that is loyalty required rather than competence or independence? And, you know, I've always been an independent. You know, so people think sometimes I'm controversial. If I don't believe in an idea, I'm not going to do it. I don't pretend to be right all the time, but I don't follow individuals or an organization. I follow my conscience. And how does my inner higher self relate to what someone is presenting me with? And that's what I am not able to compromise on. And I won't compromise, especially because You know, I'm an elder now. I'm allowed to say what I want to say. I'm saying this is my truth, and I'm standing in my truth. I'm making it absolutely clear it's not the whole truth. But if you want to engage me, why label? Why put a label to me? Because in a sense, it doesn't make sense being going from a workerist to a syndicalist to a, you know, fiery militant trade unionist to being called a Marxist, a socialist, a capitalist. I mean, I don't know how many labels I've been given in life. Alec, there's not enough place on my table to put all these labels. So I get thrown a new label. I say, oh, that's a new one. I'm a right winger now, by the way. I'm a right winger. That was an interesting one.
Wow. It was.
That is certainly a first. Jay Naidoo, the right winger. Well, but Jay Naidoo, the optimist, the idealist, the South African patriot, looks at this country. And what do you see? And how do you instill hope to those who are inheriting the young democracy?
Alec, you know, it's like sometimes when you're in the forest, you can't see the trees from the forest. So I sometimes look at some people, they say, oh, look how terrible, it's worse than when it was under apartheid. And I think, Jesus, you haven't been living under apartheid, you know? At 10 and 11, I actually believed I was inferior to white people. I believed it, because everywhere I turned, I was told that, taught that, you were lectured that, it even was in religion. And then you go to the Indian Ocean, you know, it's called the Indian Ocean. That's my ancestors, you know, but I'm not allowed to go into it. So I think that there's something that we have that is so precious. To know that no one can do that to you. I'm not saying that racism is out of our society. It's very much a social construct. It's people's reality. But no one can put up a sign, whites only anywhere, or blacks only, you know, or say Christians only or Muslims only. You know, this container of this, of how much of what we fought for, generations across every race and color, was fighting for a democracy. You know, so it's not just the Mandela generation. And they stood on the shoulders of their heroes and heroines. So it goes back so many generations to get to this point where this miracle exists. And the people that handed to us, that generation, are unimpeachable. Take the Mandela generation, Ahmed Kathrada, Chris Hani. You take every single Elias Mlangeni, you know, all of them. Their character is something you just look up and say, how did that whole generation produce people of such character and courage who are prepared to sacrifice their whole lives for the freedoms we enjoy today? And that's why I take a stand on issues. I'm not an analyst. I'm not a commentator. I don't belong to any political party. I don't frankly believe in them. I'm not in business. I've got no tender. I live off-grid, very simply. I have no need for anything from anyone. So the only truth I can stand on is my own truth. But I'm a grandfather. And I look at what we are leaving these children and grandchildren. And when I feel it's wrong, I will say it, and I don't care who's offended by it. The bigger and more powerful they are, the better for me, because I love the challenge of that. But when I draw a line on the sand, I'm telling you, Alec, people know who, that Jay Naidoo is not gone, that you knew. So if you want to have a battle with me, come fully armed with all the facts. And make sure that you've done your research, and labels don't hurt me and words don't hurt me. Because I'm not defending any ego or title that I have. Because I know how little I know. I'm defending my right to think on my own. I mean, when we inherited government in 1994, we made some mistakes, Alec. I think that the one big mistake was understanding that our freedom came because people were energized, they were passionate, they were organized, and that robustness created a situation where you couldn't maintain an unjust system. It just, people refused to cooperate with it. So we had this energy, this powerful energy. And when we got to government, we adopted a very statist approach, actually. You know, the government knows what is the best. Now the government will implement this reconstruction development program, which has now become the overarching framework of the government of national unity. But we actually demobilized everyone because we thought the government will do this. You know, it will deliver jobs. It will deliver the clinics and the hospitals and the roads and the electricity connections and whatever else. Everything you needed, the government would do it. But the government then was incapable of doing it as much as the government today is incapable of doing that. Because we did not have the capacity. So if you're designing a change of a system where you have to almost expand the level of delivery now to 100% from a 20 or 30%, you've got to redesign all the systems, the policies, the integration, the design, the consultation now, because you want people to be involved. And that would take some time. The other approach was just throwing money at the problem, which will never solve it. And so the reconstruction and the development program, however, in 1996, represented a social consensus of everyone, from the big corporates, from employers generally. Employers were discussing with shop stewards, how would they implement this notion of reconstruction development? What would be the role of this entity or this NGO? Or all of us were debating, and it gets closed down. We lose the social consensus. And so what we have today is it's a consequence of that, because social consensus in a society is important because we're a rich society as well, but we don't have a fair distribution of that wealth. And so as we are beginning to do the transition, how do we get all parties to agree on what we have to do so that our children could grow up and work together, live together, and study together, work together, build a country together? We didn't do that work, Alec. And maybe the problem lies with us, and how we create those seeds. But when it felt like there's a group that thinks they know what needs to be done, and this is the line, then there's no place for people like me. You know, I'll step out.
Jay Naidoo, it's been a pleasure talking with you in this edition of Outliers, where we have a look at South Africans who are very different. And there's no question that when they made you, Jay, they threw that mold away. It's been a privilege again. And I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.
Thank you, Alec.